Hi there, and welcome back to the Energy Sector Heroes podcast. My name is Michelle Fraser, and every week I will speak with incredible people who share their lessons, experiences, and stories from their time spent in the energy sector. Hi there, and welcome back again to this week's episode. If you're new to the show, then please take a second to subscribe and even consider sharing the show with just one other person. This week, I am joined by Gareth Evans. Gareth is the CEO and founder of Vecta. Gareth, would you like to introduce yourself, please?
Yeah, great to be here, Michelle. And I'm Gareth, CEO and founder of Vecta, originally from close to you, Liverpool, England. I'd say I'm an adventurer, family man. I've had the pleasure of living and working all around the world within the energy sector. And today, very focused on supporting businesses to access affordable, reliable, sustainable and profitable energy solutions.
Okay. How do you go about doing that then?
Yeah, So Vecta today is the platform and marketplace. And for the on-site energy industry. So what we do is we support businesses to simplify and accelerate their energy transition journey. It's very complex for many. Many don't even know what energy is, let alone why are their bills going up? Why is their power going off? Or why is it so hard for them to reduce their emissions? And what we support businesses to do is to assess and prioritize where they can get the greatest return on investment, support them to design systems that will match their specific business needs and objectives, and then get firm qualified bids from the best suppliers in the market who can then go and build these solutions for them. And what we specialize in is what's called on-site energy, so where businesses can generate and store energy right at their facility using solar, wind, gas, diesel, fuel cells, battery storage, electric vehicle charging infrastructure to really maximize how they use their energy, what they spend on it, and making sure that it shows up when they need it at the right price with the right sustainability profile to meet their specific needs.
Okay. So you were saying, mentioned before, that not a lot of people know what energy is. How do you mean? I've never heard that.
I think many of the business leaders we speak to, they obviously know that energy is critical to their operations. You know, today, energy makes up between 5 and 40% of businesses' operational costs. So it's a massive line item. But I'd say up until the last few years, the central grid where we get our energy has been reliable. Energy has largely been affordable, and not a lot of pressure is on businesses to be sustainable. And so as such, I don't think it was a very serious topic of conversation in boardrooms, in executive teams. And that's definitely changing. You know, energy costs are skyrocketing now. Power outages are increasing in frequency and duration. And the pressure from capital markets, from board members, from teams, from employees, customers to reduce emissions is mounting every day. And I think many business leaders have just paid the energy bill that shows up every month without necessarily even looking at it, not necessarily knowing what a kilowatt is, what a kilowatt hour is, where their energy comes from, how it gets there. And so I think all of this is new to a lot of people. And we see our job in being helping business leaders to understand what is going on, where their energy comes from today, what the risks are, helping them hedge those risks, and then helping them really utilize the energy transition as a huge opportunity versus a risk. You know, when done right, profitability can be achieved as well as sustainability, not instead of.
Okay. But do you really think that the energy sector can be sustainable?
Yeah, absolutely. We are seeing with our customers using the platform that using on-site energy systems combined with energy efficiency practices, they can reduce their emission profiles depending on where they are. You know, every location is unique depending on how the grid generates power, how much energy the business consumes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But we're seeing businesses being able to reduce their emissions by 30, 40, 50% plus, as well as reduce their energy costs by 10 to 50% based on what versus what they pay their grid utility provider today. And so I think we're still a ways away from being 100% sustainable. I think that's still decades in the making, but we can certainly make very significant impacts today. And I think we need to do that in a very purposeful way. As you have alluded to, this isn't a one size fits all. It's not going to make sense for all businesses, but for many, it definitely does. And we're not going to achieve this overnight, but I think we have to support businesses with the right intelligence, the right data, the right insights, and the right options to actually explore what is possible.
Okay. So you were saying that you were from Liverpool originally, yeah?
Yes.
Yeah. So where about are you based just now then?
I'm today in San Diego. It's been a bit of a unique pathway to here. After I left Liverpool to get to university, went to university at Lancaster University, studied environmental science, always had a love for geography and the outdoors. I was actually being paid for to go through university by the Royal Air Force. And so I actually always thought I was going to be a pilot, and geography was just something I enjoyed as a bit of a pastime. But that didn't work out for many reasons. I ended up traveling the world and running out of money, essentially, in Calgary, Canada. And the oil and gas industry there was booming. And I had the opportunity to work with a lot of the majors cleaning up old oil and gas well sites throughout the Rocky Mountains. So I got to live remotely on very, very extreme well pads in the middle of nowhere and helping return them back to their original form, typically crown forestry land. But that created a mega opportunity for me to go to Iraq right after the Second Gulf War and support ExxonMobil, Eni, Petronas, and many others to move into the region to really help the Iraqi oil companies to improve the way they're operating their oil fields. So I did a fairly significant project there for several years. Pretty stressful conditions, being mortar attacked most evenings, going out with personal protection teams every day. But that was my real insight into how energy is the lifeblood of everything we do. And I saw that, you know, after that years of conflict, the infrastructure had been devastated in Iraq and people were surviving on 2 to 4 hours of power a day. And that leads to really bad consequences. You know, businesses can't operate. People can't cool themselves, keep themselves warm, get access to education, water. The list goes on. And so that's when my real kind of personal mission took off for wanting to create affordable, reliable, clean power for everyone. But I worked with Worley, one of the large EPCs, and had the opportunity to head off to Perth, Australia, supported the mining, LNG, oil and gas industry to really develop and optimize some of their big projects down there. And then came back to the US, transitioned with them and ran their global power consulting practice for what we call distributed energy or on-site energy. And that's where we actually incubated the concept of Vector within the corporation and then got them to invest in our startup in 2019. So it's been a wild ride, let's say.
Okay, but that must be really difficult for many companies and even just the whole country to have a few hours of energy a day, though.
Yeah, I think this is one of the most eye-opening experiences I had, Michelle, was every morning we'd be briefed by the US military around the security issues that we may face on that any given day, any given week. And on one particular briefing, they showed us a video of a couple of guys who were releasing a rocket that was aimed at our base. And the military had access to equipment where they could detect the point of origin from where the rocket was launched. And then they were able to go out and see if they could capture the people. On this night, they hadn't captured anyone, but they found a video recorder that had been left behind that they would use to prove they had completed their objective. And what was very eye-opening for me was it was two individuals, and they were essentially, it was translated to us. They were saying, you know, it's cold, it's wet, I don't want to be here, I wish I was at home with my family. And what we were being educated was these people were being paid couple of hundred dollars to go and do this, and they weren't insurgents, they weren't terrorists, they were just you and I needing to feed our families, needing money to buy diesel for a generator. And I think it just showed to me that today we have the infrastructure to provide this reliable power, but the moment that that's gone, the consequences are very dire and very significant, and so we need to prevent that. And people don't realize how fragile the infrastructure is that we all rely on. And so, it's impossible for a country, a business, an individual to operate without access to energy. And it's becoming even harder as we electrify more and more of our lives, essentially.
I do agree. It's going to get more difficult, but I don't think that the energy sector is going to be going away anytime soon. So,
no, I think we have to be super proud of the infrastructure we built. The oil and gas industry has literally allowed us to create the quality of life that we all enjoy today. I think the challenge is the infrastructure, particularly the transmission lines, the power plants, they are now all starting to age. You know, some of the infrastructure we rely on is 50, 70, 100 years old. It's becoming less reliable, and there are many points of failure. And the risk is by relying on central infrastructure systems that when one transmission line gets taken out or one substation gets impacted, it has massive knock-on effects. And so what the vision of the future is we have a more distributed infrastructure base. So we're generating and storing energy where we need it, and then enabling that infrastructure to be able to work in tandem, communicate together, such that we've got a more resilient, adaptable, flexible, multi-pronged generation source versus relying on big central infrastructure.
Okay, is that going to be difficult to do then?
It's certainly not going to be easy the way we've sort of built our infrastructure to date. But I think what's great about these systems is because they're smaller, because they are built on the facilities where we need them, they're actually, and the equipment exists today, the capabilities exist. There's people in the market that actually want to finance these systems. And so I'd say one of the biggest misconceptions for a lot of businesses is they need to have a lot of money to go and do this. Actually, they don't need any money at all. Someone will actually pay for the asset, build it, operate it, and just sell them energy at less than what they pay their utility provider today. And then they have the resilience of having the energy infrastructure right at their facility, so power outage risks are reduced. And they're able to hedge their prices for 20 to 30 years. You know, a lot of people have done that with oil and gas and other things, but they haven't done it with electrical energy. And you can do that with an on-site system. And so I think it's more an education and awareness challenge than actually sort of an infrastructure challenge, honestly. I think we can build these systems quite quickly, quite efficiently. If we want to integrate them into the grid, that certainly adds its own complexities. But today, the opportunities exist to really gain a lot of value with not a lot of cost to the business. Like, the risk profile is very, very positive.
Okay, so how long does it take to build them then?
That's what we really want to disrupt. You know, if you rely on the way the market works today, you know, using service-led practices, whether it be consulting, engineering companies, relying on suppliers to sell you the right solution, we've seen it take anywhere from 1 to 3 years because there's just so much kind of wastage in the system. There was a study done here in the US that said anytime we deploy an on-site energy system today, up to 70% of the costs are in kind of what we call soft costs, consulting, engineering, procurement, contracts, negotiations, et cetera, et cetera. And so what we've done is we've automated a lot of that process through technology. And so we've now supported customers to assess, design, and then competitively procure systems in less than 3 months. In terms of being able to actually physically build them, it doesn't take very much time. It's solar panels on a roof, it's a battery shipping container deployed at the site and wired up. You know, the actual complexities of these systems aren't too significant on the ground. It really comes down to internal stakeholder approvals, corporate practices, and being confident to act on the data that they've received. So that's what we really want to support businesses to do, is make very informed, data-driven decisions where they can see the cash flow analysis over a 20-year or more period, and then have firm competitive quotes from the best suppliers in the market. And by driving that competitive process, we can save our customers up to 30% in capital costs. And instead of spending millions of dollars on consultants or engineers, we've compressed that down to very cheap technology-enabled access. So we kind of removed the cost, schedule, complexity barriers out the way. And now it's about trying to educate the market through conversations like this for businesses to really embrace the opportunity.
Okay, sounds interesting. But connecting to the grid, because I've had quite a few different people on the podcast, but and they always say connecting to the grid is one of the major difficulties.
It is. That's definitely one of the hardest permitting processes, and especially it's It's very different by utilities. Some utilities will really support this because they see it as, you know, they don't have to invest in generating more energy to meet the business's needs, so they can direct energy elsewhere. Some people see it as them potentially losing a customer, so they make it very hard to do this. So it's very dependent and different based on who your utility provider is today. But certainly the grid today is maxed out. It doesn't have the capacity to have more resources tied into it. And I think that's the real opportunity for distributed energy, is instead of bringing on these hundreds, if not thousands of megawatt utility scale systems, which we have to build a lot of new infrastructure for, which takes 5, 10, 15 plus years to design, permit, construct, we can now do it in far smaller chunks. So it's a totally different approach to the market.
Okay. Sounds amazing, actually. So what is the most challenging thing about your current role then?
So we launched the business 2019, end of 2019, and immediately thereafter, COVID came about. And so I'd say one of the biggest challenges has been, I had this vision of being this cool startup, all in an office together, whiteboarding, ideating, innovating. And as a result of COVID, we've ended up building a completely remote business, which is awesome because we've been able to attract the best talent from around the world. And now we've got people in Canada, US, Australia, Europe, South America. And so it's created this really flexible, high-profile, talented team. But in the process, you lose a lot of that real-time innovation, ideation that you get through in-person interaction, as well as a lot of customers ended up shifting to a point of not wanting to meet. You know, they realized that they could meet through Zoom and achieve their desired objectives. But there's still something to be said about that personal connection, the interactions, the relationships, the trust that can be built through that process. And so we managed to overcome that really well internally. We have summits several times a year where we bring the whole team together. We rent a big house. We all spend a week strategizing, working on our culture, hanging out, cooking together, doing activities. So that's really great. And then we're really starting to now see more and more customers being willing to meet. But all this leads to the fact that education and awareness is the biggest barrier in the market today. And we're really pushing hard to use the likes of these forums, our marketing channels, more people time with our customers to really help them understand that this isn't a scary unknown. This is like the smart business thing to do. So it's really trying to tell that story in a simple, understandable, engaging way is probably the biggest challenge, especially in this kind of remote world.
I would have thought so as well. So what is your zone of genius then? What are you most good at?
Me personally or our business?
Yeah, well, you personally and your business, actually.
I'd say me personally. Common sense, practical, global experience, which leads to a leadership style that is less of like all about kind of leading by example, setting the vision, setting the goals, and then letting the team run after it hard without any micromanagement, and building relationships and trust with our customers, our suppliers, our team members quickly. And I'm really kind of living and operating by core values that people connect with. I think all that leads to really the right outcomes. And I'm only able to do that because I've got an awesome family and I've got a very active lifestyle, which brings the kind of, I firmly believe there isn't such a thing as work-life balance. I believe in work-life integration. So I've been able to integrate work, pleasure, family, all into everything I do. So I think that really helps.
Do you think it's harder to run a business remotely, or do you think it's really benefited you?
I think it's actually been awesome. There's definitely moments where I wonder what it would have been like if we'd have built the whole team here in San Diego or another place on the planet. But I think what it's created is I get way more time with the family while running a very kind of high stress role and running a business and being responsible for people and projects and customers and all that good stuff. Investors' money. So I get a lot more time with friends and family while also being able to do my job. But I also get to hire and build a team with the best people in the world and having no limitations to that. And I think that's a huge opportunity. And it gives us the ability to scale globally when previously that probably would have been a very challenging task, or it would have felt very overwhelming trying to start a new office somewhere. We don't have a fixed office. You know, we almost have our flexible shop fronts where we come together where it makes sense with each other at the right times.
Okay, but then is it easier to manage people when they're working remotely? I think it would be hard.
I think if you hire the right people, it's very easy. I think as long as you can trust that they're doing the right things at the right time and representing the business in the right way and giving it their all, then it makes sense. I think as businesses scale and get probably less intimate and less personal, and it's probably harder to keep track of that and to be constantly hiring and retaining the right talent. But with the technology available today, Slack and Google and Zoom and all these different things, you know, literally we're in communication all day, every day anyway. I'd say we're probably in communication more remotely than maybe we would even be if we were all in the same office.
Okay, excellent. So how would you describe your typical working week then?
Typical work week for me, well, every day I start with the same sort of routine up at 5:30, and I like to have my lemon water, do a bit of breathing. I do a half an hour spin on my bike, and then I walk my son up to school. That's probably the best 20 minutes of my day, is just getting to hang out with him and sort of be present and in the moment and get a bit of a walk. And then I come back and I've blocked off my morning for internal focus. So whether that's strategy, sales, marketing activities, they're the things that I need to be hyper-focused on. And then in the afternoons, I then take my calls with team members, customers, suppliers. And then that's kind of the workflow. I have 15 minutes blocked right in the middle of the day to focus on taking a breath and making sure everything's under control. I have a tracking book next to me that I use. Someone gave me several years ago called Clever Fox, which is like a daily planner. So I use that every day to capture core objectives, what I've learned, what I'm grateful for, what I'm going to execute on any given day. And so I use that to make sure that I'm constantly on top of what I need to be doing and not getting distracted.
Okay. So have you ever had any career disasters then?
I've had multiple. I think very, very early on when I was a consultant in Calgary, one of my first kind of disasters was, there's something called the Calgary Stampede where the whole city kind of shuts down and everyone celebrates a big rodeo together. And got very, like, went out on an evening, several customers. And at one point, me and this customer were essentially, he was the booking bronco and I was the person riding the booking bronco. And I got called in the next day and said, you've got to know where to draw the line in terms of your relationships to your customers. I almost lost my job on that occasion. That was kind of a young, naive moment. Another one was in Iraq, actually. I was responsible for a team of 15 people, and we're all obviously working and operating under very stressful conditions. And one of the guys on the team ended up taking a photo of him looking like he's kind of being kidnapped, as a bit of an internal joke, but he posted it on social media and it created a real ruckus for us in terms of how that was received. And while I had no control over that act, we had to address it very quickly. And we all, as a project team, we almost all lost our jobs because of that. It just showed me that you need to really represent yourself and your team well at all times, and even when you think it's a joke, things can be perceived very differently when it's put into social media world. So that was a huge lesson learned. And I think the last one would be, when we started this business, I had a board member who recommended a CTO for our business. And because it was a personal recommendation, I kind of didn't do the normal vetting and interview process that maybe I would normally do with other significant hires. And the individual ended up being very toxic for the business and culture. And it took me probably over 6 months to work them out of the business. And it kind of set back a lot and created a lot of turmoil within the team. So I think the lesson learned there was, regardless of who recommends them, they, even if they're the closest people to you, do your due diligence on who you're bringing into the team, because as they say, one apple can spoil a barrel. And I think until you've lived and breathed that, you don't realize how true that is. So a few examples.
Do you really think that toxicity can cause a lot of problems in any business?
Massively, yeah. I think particularly within, you know, you were talking about remote teams before, and I think one of the primary challenges is, in a situation like that, I was in daily contact with the likes of the CTO, and I'm being fed a picture of what's happening that is very different than maybe what the people reporting to him feel. And having visibility of that and being able to kind of see through that, and having a relationship with the employees enough that they're willing to come to you with concerns and challenges that they're experiencing, I think that is one of the risks of remote, is being able to tell what is actually going on and whether you're seeing and hearing the right things. And so that's where culture and values really comes into that. So our key values are challenge limits, empower co-creation, adapt purposefully. And we use that all day, every day now, to do everything, drive everything we do in the business. But I think one toxic person actually can destroy the whole culture and value system of everything you do.
Okay. So how do you actually deal with that then? Because that must be hard as a CEO to deal with that.
Yeah, extremely hard, especially when you know, the legal implications of managing people out of the business is very challenging, regardless of where you are in the world. You know, regulations change quite significantly, but having senior people in the business who have been around the block and know how the system works, as soon as they get a whiff of there being an issue, they can play the system quite strategically and make it very challenging. And so, yeah, it's about doing your due diligence, documenting the challenges, making sure there's very clear conversations explaining why there is a problem. And then at the right time, with the right evidence and the right support, acting on it. And I think always in hindsight, it feels like you should have made the decision earlier, but I'm a firm believer in giving people the benefit of the doubt and making sure that you're empathetic and you truly understand in the right situation. Sometimes that can make the process longer than it needs to be, but at least then you can act with confidence, knowing that you've done everything you can to try and remedy the situation, instead of just, you know, jump into the pulling the pull where. But anytime I've had to do that in my career, it always ends up being the best outcome. There's never, you know, for the individual and for the business, because often if they're not right for your business, it also means they're not happy doing what they're doing. And so hard in the moment, very emotionally challenging, but largely always the right thing to do.
Okay. So when you are interviewing someone, what would you normally look for?
Yeah, we actually bring it back a lot to those core values. So how is an individual challenge the limits? You know, one of the really interesting questions that was shared with me that I often ask is, like, you know, take yourself back to a time when you were, you know, 8, 10, 12, like, what did you do to challenge your limits? And it's a very interesting question, because they say that kind of the values you display back then are very reflective of how you still operate to this day. So, you know, trying to find unique questions like that, where it gets beyond the pre-rehearsed kind of tact that a lot of people will take, but really making sure that we dig into how people challenge the limits, when they've run into challenges, how have they adapted with purpose, how have they collaborated with other people to build that community, build that outcome. So trying to really tie the whole process to those values, gut instinct, making sure that there's a good fit, and then you know, doing good reference checks for sure, and actually just not making snap decisions. I think we've always been burnt when we've made quick decisions because we think we need someone in the seat. But, you know, the likes of our head of sales, Dan, he and I spoke for probably over a year before I ended up hiring him. And we went on mountain bike rides together. We had beers together, you know. So I got to see the individual outside of just kind of a confined interview process. And we also, especially for some of the technical roles, do case study work. So we actually set people a challenge and see how they operate. And we really don't necessarily care what the results look like, but we like to see how did they approach it? What tactics did they apply? How do they communicate their thinking process? It's definitely all about kind of the aptitude, attitude, rather than the actual, their technical expertise. It's about getting down to their core characteristics.
Okay. But then I think that would be quite a hard question to answer. I mean, how would you challenge yourself? How did you challenge yourself as an 8-year-old? That would be quite hard to answer, actually.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of the beauty of it, is people have to actually reflect on. It could be, you know, for me personally, it could be something along the lines of, like, at the age of 9, I was 11, actually. At the age of 11, I was doing a paper round 5 days a week at 5:30 every morning. I was through rain, hail, sleet, snow, up, doing my round, and working hard, working consistently. You know, it could be as simple as something like that, you know, showing that you are willing to take the initiative and get out there and fend for yourself and do something interesting.
Okay. Interesting. Interesting answer.
Yeah.
Yeah. So is there anything that you'd still like to achieve in your career then?
Absolutely. My mission personally is to create reliable, affordable, clean power for everyone. Today, we're focused on businesses because they are, you know, they have the biggest energy needs, they have the biggest emission profiles, and they've also got the money to do something about it. And so that's the priority today. I want Vector to be the platform that every business leader in the world thinks about when they think about energy. And so that's what we're building towards. That's the mission, that's the objective. And I think it's attainable. I think the energy industry is a huge opportunity. I think we're going to go through a multi-decade transition, and it's rife for disruption. And a lot of people don't realize how important it is to our lives. They're not making it interesting. They're not making it fun. They're not providing the experience that customers need and want. And so I want to wrap all of that into an incredible product, team, culture, brand that the best talent in the world wants to work for, and customers all around the world want to work with, because it's the right thing to do. It's the profitable thing to do. And if we do it right, we'll create a thriving future for all, where we can actually all enjoy the reason we're here, which is kind of the primary outcome.
Okay. Excellent answer, actually. It is an excellent answer. So what keeps you motivated when times get tough then?
Certainly there's always setbacks and roadblocks and many punches in the face every day. I think it's having that clear mission, vision, having the game plan. And my mantra for this quarter is show up every day, no excuses. And I think that's kind of key to all of this, is that you need to just stay consistent, stay persistent, show up every day, and it will come, you know, as long as you're learning, adapting. And yeah, the motivation is that we all need energy. And so if we don't have a world where we have access to energy, bad things happen. And I do not want to see those bad things happen. I've experienced it in Iraq, and people think that that's an extreme use case, and it's definitely not. You know, our infrastructure is in a very vulnerable predicament, and it would not take many cascading of events for us all to be sat here wondering why our lights are not turning on, or why our plant hasn't started up. And that has pretty bad consequences. And I want to make sure that we have the fun, thriving outcomes versus the high risk downside opportunities.
Yeah, but dealing with, I mean, when you were working in Iraq, that must have been really hard and very challenging though.
It definitely was. I'd say for probably 2 years afterwards, I probably suffered a bit of PTSD in hindsight. Took myself to hospital a few times thinking I was having a heart attack afterwards. I couldn't get on a train, a plane, a bus without kind of feeling really anxious. I constantly felt like I needed to go to the toilet. And so then I'd think about it, stress out about it. And there was this like horrible, horrible anxiety every time I felt in a confined place. But I think that's where, I always then turn back to exercise and the breathing and the cold plunges and all the things I enjoy doing, because that kind of keeps you present and in the moment and makes you, and having gone through something like that, you realize that a lot of the things that feel like setbacks on any given day are actually, minor speed bumps, and they are very, they're inconsequential in the grand scheme of things. And so you get a better appreciation for what is actually stressful and what actually should make you anxious. And I think bringing the right energy and positivity and the right integrated lifestyle to the problem statement allows you to kind of keep going.
Okay. So this year, you're going to just focus, is your main activity to focus on growing your business then?
Yeah. We've got amazing kind of global enterprise customers, and it's all about making sure that they achieve their desired objectives and outcomes. And success for us is when businesses deploy the projects and get the benefits in terms of cost savings, reduced emissions, things that they can use to really benefit their business. So that's the real push. We've built an amazing platform. We're constantly optimizing that. So there'll be lots of developments there to support customers to really plan their energy transition strategies at scale and consider on-site energy, but also understand, if I was to execute energy efficiency, how would that support me? If I wanted to buy renewable carbon credit offsets, how much would that cost me? How would that feed into my strategy? So being able to provide that kind of holistic strategy for their energy transition. And I think a big part of that, we've got our own podcast called Renewable Rides. So really continuing to grow that, because it's these sort of conversations that I think really help people build that awareness and understanding in a very non-conflicting way. It should feel a lot more engaging and understandable. So constantly trying to simplify the story and make people see what's possible. That's kind of the big push for me personally. The rest of the team has the sales, the marketing, the product under control. For me, it's about maybe being a bit more of the face of the business, building our brand and taking it beyond kind of our direct network and expanding that globally.
So everybody is talking about the reducing their footprint to as near as net zero as possible. Do you think that you would be able to contribute to that then?
Yeah, 100%. Actually, there's some studies that show that of all the companies that have committed to net zero, literally less than 7% of those companies actually have an energy transition plan in place. And less than 1% are actually going to achieve those objectives based on their plans today. So the opportunity is huge. The risk for these businesses is mounting. I think a lot of people have realized that they set these goals. They didn't have a plan in place. They went out and bought a bunch of carbon offsets. They're now being called out for greenwashing. And there's an opportunity here to act and actually reduce your emission profile directly versus doing it through someone else. And I think that's how we will have a huge impact, is supporting businesses through solar, through wind, through batteries, through EV chargers, through gas turbines to reduce their profiles right at their facilities, but actually then get the win-win benefit of increased resilience and reduced costs.
Okay, because I thought most companies would have a pretty secure plan about how they were going to reduce their carbon footprint.
That's what we'd all like to believe. And it's certainly, I think, what we would be led to believe, whether you read sustainability plans or other. But these are studies done by the leading management consultants in the world that kind of publicly put out these statistics. And I think we're always surprised, even the biggest businesses in the world, they may have, tactically done a few things, but they don't have a very holistic, well thought out, well monetized strategy or plan to execute at scale. And this is the challenge. It's easy to do one or two projects, but if you're a company that's got tens, hundreds, thousands of facilities around the world, how do you ensure that you are targeting the facilities with the greatest return on investment and you're doing that at scale? So this is what we want to really unlock, is that scalability.
Okay. And how do you propose to unlock the scalability then?
Well, through our platform, we can literally ingest hundreds, if not thousands, of sites all around the world. And, you know, with very little data from the customer, we're able to immediately show them across their entire portfolio what the opportunity is, where they get the greatest return on investment, how much emissions they could potentially reduce, what the right system would be for their business. And then once we've done that, we can help them then for the high priority sites, actually in a solution agnostic way. You know, we're not trying to sell anyone anything. We actually look at how are they using energy today? Where do they get it from? How much is it costing them? And then we design them a system that will achieve whatever their business objective is, cost, resilience, or emission reduction. And so we look at all technologies equally, and we run very complex optimizations. We look at hundreds of thousands of different variables. And so the whole industry is working on spreadsheets, and you cannot look at this problem statement from the simplicity of a spreadsheet. It takes very complex sort of engineering, math, science. So we take that approach and we make sure that customers get the right system for their needs, not what the market thinks they need to buy. You know, the way the market sells today is suppliers want to sell you their panels or their wind turbines or their battery, but you don't know who to believe. You don't know what system is right for you. So we want to arm you with the right intelligence, data, insights to know what is right for your needs. And then we make sure we go and get you competitive quotes from the market. So instead of you relying on the one or two suppliers that you can Google or that are in your network because you've worked with them in the past, it doesn't necessarily mean that they're the right supplier for this particular project. So we screen the suppliers, we pre-qualify them, and then we make sure we put out a bid to the market, which drives the best outcomes for you, manages your risks, your performance guarantees, warranties, contractual needs. And we make sure that by creating that competitive landscape that we reduce the costs of those systems by as much as possible. The cheaper we get the systems, the more people adopt them, the more of these systems we build, which reduces the cost further. So it becomes a self-fulfilling cycle. So we want to really unlock that self-fulfilling cycle and make these systems really accessible to businesses at scale.
Okay, so you provide a whole service then to the companies from start to finish then?
That's right. All technology enabled, supported by individuals with unique expertise. So we know that a lot of businesses, they want to be handheld through this process, but they don't want to spend millions of dollars on a consultant to do that. So we've built a technology that does a lot of the heavy lifting for them. And then we use our experts to talk them through it and then step them through the process to make sure that they are truly comfortable making these decisions, because they are one-way door decisions, as we say. You're buying a system that will last you for the next 15 to 25 years, and you do not want to put your money into the wrong system. So we want to make sure that customers invest in the right systems. But yes, end-to-end, because we help you assess, design, deploy, and then we even monitor the asset once it's built and make sure that you get what you paid for. And if you're not getting what you paid for, we help you ensure that you do. And then as years go on, and maybe the system needs to be upgraded, by monitoring the system, we're able to help give you those insights. You know, maybe you need to add a new battery to the system because batteries have come down in price or your utility rates have changed. So we're constantly providing that dynamic intelligence to ensure that business leaders are not just working on a snapshot in time. It's real time, it's up to date, and it's interactive.
Okay, so how would a new graduate get into that sort of type of role then?
Yeah, we actually have one starting with us next week. She's coming on as one of our energy modeling experts. And this is a young market, so you don't necessarily have to have specific expertise in the sector per se. You know, we've hired everyone from economists to capital experts to renewable project developers to people who have been in oil and gas their whole careers and now they want to transition out. So I'd say there's no single channel I'd say you have to come from. I'd say you have to have a passion for the industry. You have to have a core skill set that you can apply. And you have to be willing to see that this is a technical and a financial opportunity. And so you can't get stuck in the technicalities of a system and all the engineering nuances. You need to also understand that these systems have to be profitable. They have to be economic. They have to be viable. And so whether it's a lot of us have environmental science backgrounds, geography, engineering, economists, finance, it doesn't really matter. But I think look for a business that aligns in terms of your values, your motivations, and has the right mission and objectives, and then figure out how to get in there through networking and knocking on the door a lot.
Okay. So do you have any advice for anybody, any young graduates wanting to come into the energy sector?
Yeah, I think say yes, take the risk. A lot of people say that they want to travel the world and work in this industry. And when it actually comes down to leaving friends, family, moving homes, taking a slight pay cut to change sectors, people aren't willing to do that. And so those that are willing to take that risk, put themselves out there, say yes, have a crack at it, the doors open very quickly. And don't just use the technical side of the industry to get in. My first job, I was given it because I knocked on the company's door incessantly until they got bored of me knocking. And then when I got interviewed, they had a race coming up, a running race and a mountain bike race. And I said I'd be willing to join the corporate team. And so they hired me on that basis, I think, versus my technical experience. And so a lot of it comes down to personality and timing and having a unique background that is interesting to people.
Okay. So do you think that persistency is quite key to getting maybe your first start in a company then?
Yes. Especially if you see a specific company that you're hyper-focused on wanting to work with. I think we see today that people are so overwhelmed with information, whether it be through social media or their emails or internal Slack or team channels, that unless you're showing up, and unless you're showing up in a way that's adding value to people, you're not going to get a look in. So definitely don't be persistent by just ask. It's being persistent by creating value, showing a proactive approach, bringing something unique or different, and being actually willing to get out and socialize and network. And so finding the people that you want to interact with in unique places.
Okay. So I'm going to ask you maybe one final question. If you could turn back time, would you change anything?
I would not. It's been a wild ride so far. I think fit a lot in, done amazing things, and excited for where it's gonna lead to. I think the biggest lesson is probably just always being live in the moment, take things as they come. And my favorite quote is live life on the edge or you're taking up too much space. And so I think you're not going to get to where you want to go without taking some risks and making some mistakes. And it's not worth getting sucked into thinking about the past. Got to crack on and move forwards.
I think that's excellent advice, actually. Okay, I'm going to wrap things up now. That's all the questions I have today. I would like to thank Gareth for your time. That brings us to the end of another episode. Thanks for listening and see you next week. That brings us to the end of another episode. Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, I'd like to gently encourage you to leave a 5-star rating wherever you listen to podcasts and share the show with another person. You can also follow me on LinkedIn or via my website, www.michellefraserconsultancy.com. Thanks again for listening and see you next week.